Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen, a cooking store located at 100 Frost Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Join me every Wednesday as I talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. You can find Feast Your Ears as well as lots of great other shows at heritageradionetwork.org and on iTunes. In the studio with me today for my second episode is Tony Butler, the executive director of St. John's Bread and Life. Bread and Life is located in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, and is one of the largest soup kitchens, food pantries, and social services providers in the New York City area. They serve about 2,500 hot meals daily to hungry New Yorkers and offer an incredibly long list of other amazing services. Tony, thank you for joining me today. Yeah,
it's great to be here.
Regular listeners to Heritage Radio may already know a little bit about you. You've been on a number of other programs. But for my listeners, can you please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do?
As you mentioned, I'm Tony Butler, the executive director of St. John's Bread and Life. And what I do is run a very large and sadly needed emergency feeding program. We're actually above those stats you mentioned. We're almost at 3,000 meals a day, providing hot meals, a food pantry. We have a mobile soup kitchen. And on top of meeting the hunger needs in New York City, which right now one in five New Yorkers uses emergency food programs like us, 20% of the city, about 1.8 million, and one in four children use it. We have a range of services. We help people sign up for food stamps. We have a large tax program, provide clothes for people. We have a large immigration program. We have medical services on site. We have a unique kind of initiative with St. John's University called Project ID, where we help people get birth certificates, non-driver's IDs, and the like, all with the kind of intent of both preventing their poverty, if you will, from getting worse, and also helping them lifting them out of poverty.
Right. I have to say the last time I was at Bread and Life, I was incredibly impressed by all of the things that you guys offer, that it wasn't just – you weren't just offering a hot meal twice
right,
a day.
Right.
You weren't just offering a food pantry, but you were offering legal services and cooking classes and all these
all
other things to really help people, get on or stay on their feet, the way that we think about it. And I like the way that you address that it's sadly needed.
Yeah.
Other folks that I know, Ann Cansfeld at the – Greenpoint Reformed Church, where they also run a soup kitchen and pantry that's somewhat smaller, but still, growing every year, sadly, likes to talk about that, in an ideal world, the soup kitchen would be out of business.
Exactly.
How did you come to be the executive director at Bread and Life? Have you always worked in social services?
I've worked in human services, social services. I come out of a religious background. I was a Franciscan brother for 10 years and always been drawn to that kind of working to use my skills to assist folks who had some ways less than me. Though this job, kind of funny, my wife sent my resume in. And I got a call, and I'm like, who are you? And this was in the days before you had, like Idealist and LinkedIn and all that. So I thought, maybe I sent a resume, I don't remember. And so I'm like just mumbling and trying to fake it. And it's turned into this job.
Oh, that's really... That's amazing. So she sent in your resume without knowing.
She saw an ad in some newspaper and sent it in. Hmm.
Yeah. You grew up, I believe, near outside Albany.
Yes,
right. Yeah. Is that where you were a Franciscan brother?
Well, I was a Franciscan brother in Albany, but also I worked in North Carolina. I worked at Covenant House in New York. Worked in Massachusetts, at Holyoke, Massachusetts, outside of Springfield. So kind of worked up and down the East Coast.
Got it. And was that work also in social?
It all was in social. I mean, I started my work working kind of with, well, not kind of, but with disabled and homeless Vietnam vets, developing a program in Chicopee, Massachusetts, and then moved down to North Carolina, where actually that's the first time I ever did emergency food. I ran, besides working in a parish, I ran a three-county ecumenical group called ACTS that would help folks with food and immediate assistance. But it was this different world. We gave out live pigs. We gave out firewood. That was during the early 80s when Ronald Reagan had the amnesty program for immigrants. And most of these were still – it was just real tobacco country. In fact, I crowned a Miss Tobacco one year. It was the honor to go to the – that was the event of the year, was this whole tobacco fair. I learned tobacco is like wine, except it's not healthy, but it's just as geeky as wine. But we did a lot of work around immigration, which really got me kind of interested and knowledgeable on immigration. Then worked at Covenant House, met my wife. I was her boss for about 3 days. That really failed, but the marriage has been, for 24 years, been good. So,
do you still work together?
No, only when I'm cleaning and she's telling me what to do around the house. But, excuse me. But so that led me here. Prior to this job, I'd worked 14 years helping develop housing for the homeless mentally ill. New York housing for deinstitutionalized folks here in Brooklyn. So I've been working here in Brooklyn for, I think, about 26, 27 years now.
Quite a lot of changes.
Yeah, just a few.
In the borough and in the city as a whole. I'm really struck by what you said about handing out pigs and firewood as something to, give people in a sort of food shed or in a food way. Is there anything here at Bread and Life now in Brooklyn that you give out that you feel is specific to an urban life?
Well, I think that the urban life that's kind of developed over the last probably 10 years in terms of this real sustainably grown, locally grown produce, it's really become much more part of urban life, surprisingly, than it is of rural life.
That's a very good point.
When I go to see my family who still live upstate, most are buying kind of mass-produced ConAgra kind of food in the grocery stores. I mean, it's changing a bit, but you see a lot less sustainably and organic in that kind of world grown unless you go to very specialty places. Where here you see it, there's a bodega on my block that has an organic section. I've seen that big change, and I've seen the kind of conversation around food that's happened here in Brooklyn. I mean, that's one of the reasons probably I've done some of these radio shows and gotten involved with this community, that the conversation around food that's, I think, somewhat different than the kind of national conversation. Because I think that the popular national conversation around food is still very competitive or instructional. I mean, they're teaching how to make something, or it's this kind of Iron Chef, or yelling. It's food versus food kind of merged with sports, where I see a lot of the food movement here, particularly in Brooklyn, which I think has led the way in a lot of it, is around that people coming together and using food, coming together around good food, and also recognizing that their eating choices have impacts and consequences to a larger community.
Right. So people do, I think, hear, and I see what you're saying about the national food conversation being about the sort of contest idea.
Yeah.
And I see it, too, when I've traveled outside of New York City. You do go to large supermarket chains, and some of them do have organic stuff, but by and large you are seeing sort of larger, more industrialized food and here in the city. And I would guess that some of that is due to the distribution network that exists in New York City, where if you already have an organics company distributing to a store like ours, like the Brooklyn Kitchen or a Whole Foods, they can also stop at the bodega.
Right.
It's very easy.
Yeah.
It doesn't take another truck trip or any of those
things. We've benefited from that from Bread and Life. I mean, we spend about, between spending and donating, probably around $1 million a year on food. And I'm running right now about 200,000 of locally grown and sustainably grown. Mostly New York State or the kind of tri-state, but we're able to benefit from ex-farmer coming to Union Square. He doesn't mind dropping off a little extra to us,
right?
Or that kind of thing, or the Green Mark and Grand Army Plaza, or something like that.
And then, do you then pass through that information to the people who are using your services, who are getting that produce? They also understand that that's from New York?
We do. We pass that through. We pass it through in cooking too, to try to normalize it. That this stuff is just not, the odd, weird, winter green. Because there's a lot of kind of a knowledge lack or a knowledge deficit in terms of a lot of particularly produce and what to do with it.
Sure. I mean, I think a lot of the produce, especially in the local movement, there is a certain celebration of the odd.
Yes, right? There is.
So there's celebration of interesting heritage varietals, which, of course, are important to grow for a whole host of reasons. But then, that that sounds like, I mean, that presents a difficulty for the farmer trying to sell it even at the market. And I'm sure in your market and the people who help who you're helping, you know, showing them an oddly colored or oddly shaped potato makes it even harder.
It does. I mean, we had these carrots come in and the staff took them home and cooked them and figured out what to do with it. We had no idea. They were just they were actually quite good, but no one knew exactly how to use them.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and that's great because then you're having your staff who can then talk to the people who are using the services about what to do with these great carrots. I mean, you know, it's interesting to discover the correlation. I mean, we do the same thing.
Yeah.
My staff takes home the vegetables that come through the door, and we don't know what a squash tastes like that we've brought in.
Right.
There's so many varieties. We take them home or we test them out in the shop and figure it out, and then we talk to our customers about it. Same sort of thing. In your time at Bread and Life, what do you think are some of your greatest successes?
I think really creating a sense of community around food that's become, and shifting, at least in our little control, we're doing, depending on the year, between 800,000 and 1 million meals a year, really changing, at least in our local little world, the diet of folks, exposing them to new foods, seeing that these foods are not this kind of, I may say this on the radio, they're not this kind of yuppie hipster kind of food. But these are normative, that people can eat them, that they're accessible to everyone, and you can bring your own kind of cultural flavor to it, if you'll pardon the pun, to different things and modify them. And so that's been very exciting. And really, I think we've done some work in moving the kind of emergency food conversation away from just kind of product and quantity, and here's, you know, 15 cans of ravioli or something like that, and a bag of beans. Two, that food is kind of fundamental to what we do. And it's not just the lack of nutrition that's hurting people, but it's the lack of commonality. It's the lack of coming together. And so we've been able to address that. And with that, bring in some of this kind of food world into that and show. I remember early on when I did one of these radio shows, it wasn't a radio show, it was an event here at Roberta's, and I spoke for a few minutes, and I challenged a lot of restaurateurs to say, look, you provide very good food to people with means. What about people without means? They didn't throw me out. They actually bought me a drink, and the conversation started.
Right.
And so I'm very proud of that the notion that hunger is a communal problem, and so we need to bring the community together to deal with it.
And I think that the way that you've been able to, at least the way that I saw the food pantry side of things operating, where the people who are coming and using that service get a choice.
What? Choice.
And I think that is really important and really valuable in terms of making it clear that it's not just a handout.
Right.
You're not handing someone a bag of food and saying, this is what I can give you,
exactly.
And this is what, you know, you'll be able to live on this, but you're allowing people, and the system at Bread and Life, for anyone who has not seen it, is really it's incredible, and it is really technologically savvy, and the clients come in and they can choose from a whole
off a touch screen. For the listeners who don't know, we have a digital food pantry because I want to give people choice, but I also want to understand how people are using food, because I have an obligation to be a good steward of the funds and resources that are given to Bread and Life. And so folks, it's kind of a debit system where they get a certain amount of points and order off a touchscreen. Kind of do the Whole Foods thing upside down, that the more nutritious is cheaper, the less nutritious is more expensive. The Whole Foods has been a very good supporter of us, so I don't want to disparage them. But that notion, and allow people to have choice, because food, you need to have choice.
Absolutely. Yeah. Are there things that you have... I guess, brought in or that have been donated that have been very popular with the clients or customers? I don't know how you describe them.
We actually call them guests.
Guests that you wouldn't have expected to be a popular item. I mean, I guess what I'm thinking about is, you know, at the Brooklyn Kitchen, because I'm now seeing so many correlations here. We sell a lot of kimchi.
Yeah.
But we're not selling it to Korean folks,
right?
You know, and that is a product we sell a lot of, and we brought it in because we thought it would be good to have on the shelf, and it turned out to be a hit.
Kimchi is actually a funny thing, though. We served kimchi, we didn't know what to do with it, so we served it with sausages because we thought sauerkraut. Because when Guga Muga, the last time when it sort of failed on the bad weather,
right?
We got tons of stuff. We went and rescued a bunch of food, so that is an interesting. That's one of them. I think also the winter greens, because through an educative process, people didn't understand that you could eat good greens in the winter, and now they're asking. We don't get enough of them.
So kale has become popular across the board.
And the small potatoes, the kind of colored, different small potatoes, which first folks didn't even know they wouldn't eat. We served them in the soup kitchen; they didn't know what's this purple thing, and then. That's changed.
They really like it. That's great. And so you're running a location in Brooklyn,
right?
And that is the home base. And then you have a mobile soup kitchen,
yes,
that is in built on a truck platform,
right?
And goes out to Queens. Does that go to the same place all the time?
It goes to the same place every day. So it does 2 meals a day, 5 days a week. So and I can't remember the exact schedule, but every Monday morning it would be at the same place. We serve Queens. In Jackson Heights and Far Rockaway, we serve Brownsville, we serve Williamsburg, East New York, and Williamsburg. Several of our sites are day laborer sites. And one of the interesting sites, listeners may not know, is there's a large women day laborer population that we serve on Division Street. An interesting mix of new Polish immigrants and women from Central America who are essentially, they're not even Spanish-speaking, they're Quechuan-speaking. And there are these, I remember asking one of the women, because I said, you speak English fairly well, and you don't speak Spanish. She told me that the men spoke Spanish because they go into the towns, but these women are from the rural parts and they speak their native tongue.
And so there's no need to speak Spanish.
No, so she learned English. And I swear she walked from Peru to here. But,
right, that's very interesting. And what are, I mean, day laborers in terms of being picked up on the street corner the way they do for construction,
exactly,
that sort of thing?
Most of them are doing the clean out construction and things like that. Yeah. Some in the summer months, some landscaping and work like that. And our mobile soup kitchen tries to replicate the services we have at Bread and Life, because we also have an office in the back, fax capability, the Wi-Fi, our satellite hookup, so we can connect with our database. Obviously, it's a different world, different kind of environment to work on if it's raining and snowing, but both provide the food and connect people with services, so maybe they don't need our food as much. Our mobile soup kitchen was very busy during Sandy. We were out there the day of the storm and for a year afterwards, along with providing our regular mobile services.
Wow, so it's running, yeah, running a lot of meals.
In fact, it was my old one, which I think Sandy sort of destroyed it.
Well, I mean, you guys are really putting it to incredibly heavy use, so I would imagine it's something that takes a lot of wear and tear. I think we're going to take a short break and hear from one of our sponsors. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about Bread and Life and some other things that are going on in the city.
If I had a magic wand, tomorrow everyone in the world would have enough food to eat that was culturally appropriate and delicious. The planet would be thriving because all the food would have been grown and produced in a way that sustains us, both our bodies and our world. But man, I do not have a magic wand. What I do have is you and this radio station, the Heritage Radio Network. That's what we're here to do. We're here to help lead the way to a future that's more delicious, that's more fun, where we're healthier, where the planet's healthier, and we want you to be a part of that. We can't do it without you. As a nonprofit radio station, we depend on the support of our listeners. So take a minute out of your day, visit the website, and click the big beating donate tab. Throw us a few bucks. Every bit helps. We're counting on you.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen here in Williamsburg. And my guest today, if you're just joining us, is Anthony Butler, who's the executive director of St. John's Bread and Life here in Brooklyn. I recently read about a school bus in Boston that's been converted into a mobile farm stand.
Yes.
And they bring it into underserved neighborhoods. Is that something that you've considered at all with Bread and Life, to do something like that?
We have considered. I've not figured out the logistics of it and the funding and the practicality of it. I think it's a great idea. Part of me would rather, and the city was toying with this for a while ago, but it's dwindled a bit, is figure how we could partner with extant stores. Hmm. Who kind of, you know, if you could underwrite or take care of their produce.
I know there was a green market program some years ago to try and put a cooler of fresh green market produce into bodegas.
It was, I mean, it's a way to address the kind of food desert. So that, I think that conversation shifted a bit. There is access, and we do. I mean, we're part of a CSA at Bread and Life, and we so and I think there's some of that kind of fresh produce stuff can happen on kind of physical sites. And it's also that there are New York's much more denser than Boston. People have much better transportation opportunities and like that. So
yeah, and one of the things that seemed to me that might be difficult because of the density would be that you just wouldn't be able to hold enough produce. I mean, you could stop in one place and
it would just
everything would disappear,
right.
And then you'd have to sort of start over again.
And a mobile option, any mobile option, is the most expensive. In terms of staffing, in terms of fuel, in terms of insurance and all that, it is the most I mean, even our mobile soup kitchen is probably our highest price per meal because of delivering it.
Right, right. How do you determine the sites where the mobile kitchen goes and stops?
It's done by my staff, actually. I really take their recommendation. They kind of have the word on the street. We do it by kind of people voting with their feet. If numbers start dwindling at a certain site, we'll start looking for another one. We've never had problems finding one.
Right.
We've had some, you have to be sensitive to the community when you're going to park there, clean up and all that. But yeah,
sure. So in New York this week, Pope Francis is arriving. He's in Washington today, meeting with the president. And I send out a questionnaire to all of my guests before the show. And one of my questions is, if you could have dinner with anyone, who would it be? And your answer was the Pope.
Yeah.
What would you imagine a dinner with the Pope to be like? What would you want to talk to him about?
I'd want to talk to him about how he's been able to take kind of ancient and traditional church teaching and maybe not reframe it, but restate it in a way. First of all, it's attractive to many people. And he's reframed it that it's not a series of kind of dogmas, rules, but that it's about interconnectivity. I mean, his great line from his newest encyclical on in global warming and creation, Laudato Si, he talks about it's not us in nature, it is all creation, and we are part of creation.
Sure.
So I thought, what a different – and I've never heard that, you know, the church talk about that, viewing as that we are part of creation. There's a hierarchy and different roles in creation, but it's not something external to us.
Yeah, I found that encyclical. I mean, I'm not Catholic. I grew up Jewish. Yeah. Today's Yom Kippur,
right.
But I'm not fasting. I don't really ascribe to it anymore. But I found that encyclical about climate change fascinating because I don't remember a time, at least in my memory, that a pontiff took a position on something like climate change, which I feel like is usually cast as a corporate or political issue, and one that is, you know, it's about what the companies are doing and what the governments are doing. And so for him to take that position, I think, is really...
It hasn't been done really since the late 19th century when Leo X talked about labor unions. There was a document on labor and the rights of unions and the rights of people to control, to value their own kind of labor. And they have a right to be paid justly for it, and rules and stuff. But no, it's a rare thing. And it shouldn't be. The church has always supposed to have been in the marketplace.
Right.
It's a church that's always been kind of incarnational, and even if you're Catholic, I mean, we have smoke and things and statues. It's a very physical church. So there's no reason it shouldn't be in this very physical world and talking about it and bringing it. And that's, I think, what Francis is doing a very good job, even coming here.
Right. You know. Right. I mean, it's progressive.
Yeah,
I mean,
it is.
It's a
very
progressive position to take. So if you were going to have the Pope over for dinner, what would you serve?
I heard he likes chicken.
Yeah.
So I would. I would scout that out first.
Yeah.
And probably some Argentinian food, you know, to make them right. feel comfortable.
Right.
Nothing too grand, but I think I would invite the right people because I have a sense he's a guy who likes to talk in a dinner conversation. So I personally like to arrange dinner parties. My family teases me that I serve in courses whenever I have a family gathering because it forces people to sit and talk and drink and carry on conversations and discuss things as opposed to just eating and running.
That's a really good point, and I'm going to take that, and I'm going to use that, especially with my I have a 6-year-old who, you know, doesn't like to sit at the table, but really loves to talk.
Right.
And so I think that could really help. We tend to serve things family style once at our house because sometimes it's easier. But I really like that idea of serving in courses to force the conversation.
I started serving chocolate sorbet for the little kids, and they loved it. If you serve sorbet between the meals, and they have ice cream in between the meals, then they think it's really cool. But I would do, if I had that real luxury and that real honor to have dinner with the Pope, to have that, to just... I was amazed. I was at a event at Roberta's, and Carlo, what's his last name? One of the founders of Slow Food. He was there.
Oh, Petrini.
Petrini. And Alice Waters was there. And they were talking about, and Carlo was going on through translation, talking about... First of all, he had a call. He's walking down the street in Italy. He gets this call, and he hears... He decides to answer. He doesn't recognize the number. And he answers it and realizes as he's listening to this very heavily accented Italian that it's the Pope calling him because Carlo had sent him his book. And he wanted to call him and say, thank you, I really like the idea of sustainable. And they talk for like 20 minutes walking down the street. So Carlo's telling this story. And I'm looking at all, you know, these 30-somethings out here at this nice little event. And Carlo's essentially talking about the Catholic social teaching and everyone's listening to it. So that there's such a powerful thing if it can be articulated in the right way. And this was being articulated around food and labor and what it takes to produce food and what food does or does not do to the environment, how it can be toxic to the environment. I mean, not the food itself, but, you know, the production of food and talking about all that and really creating a very interesting conversation that's not being done in our political world. Our political world is calling each other names.
Right. And not talking about coming together.
No.
And food, really.
And having disagreements. I mean, the Pope said that. It was a conversation when he was in Cuba, and he talked about, we'll have disagreements. That's okay.
and that's some of the fun, right, of a dinner party. I mean, I'll be visiting my in-laws this weekend, and you know, my father-in-law, and I'm sure he won't mind me saying this on the radio, and I don't necessarily always share the same political ideas. You know, and I find that to be interesting.
Yeah, it is. My in-laws are very similar, Indiana, and very Republican, and most of them have very good conversations.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. No, so, they absolutely are.
Yeah. And I think that brings something forward when you have those conversations. It's actually a creative process. It can create if it's reasonable people. If it's not people just trying to beat you up so you agree with them. But if it's really they're articulating something or they're trying to articulate something, you may agree with the underlying value. Don't agree with the expression. Frequently, that's what good political conversation is about. We both have the same values. We just don't think we should go at it the same way.
Right. Absolutely. So I would love to talk about how people can get involved with Bread and Life and with what you're doing. Obviously, I'm sure you have a large staff and there's funding for that, and I'm sure you're always hiring for new people.
Right,
but
right.
I also I know that there's a lot of volunteer as well.
Brett, we have a significant – we did, I think, over 30,000 volunteer hours last year. So we have a significant need for volunteers. All that can be found on our website at www.breadandlife.org. Fill out our volunteer application. We do have need for funding. One of the things folks may not understand is hunger is not really being responded to on any kind of political level. We are 91% privately funded, only about 9% government funded. And actually, most of that government funding comes from the city, city and the state. New York State and the city have done some significant kind of hunger relief. The feds, not at all. So we have needs of that. We have needs of advocacy. I'd love people to just write me or call me to understand what this hunger problem is. And we also have many events during the year where you can learn about us, have a good time. We're going to be having several supper clubs coming through. And so visit our website, give us your email address, and we'll keep you informed.
Yeah, and please share all of that information with me, and I can put it up over our social media. You know, I think that one other thing that is important to me, and, you know, we talk about this, I talk about it relatively often, is, and I'm sure you do too, the idea that, you know, we talked earlier about the larger sort of food landscape in this country. Mm-hmm. And people tend to really, it seems to me, think about hunger and the hungry right at the end of the year.
Yeah.
Around Thanksgiving and Christmas, when people are getting together and around the holidays with their families to eat, is when that becomes something that's present in their mind. But, you know, very clearly from your data points and from what you see every single day, you know, it's the same on September 23rd as it is on July 14th, as it is on Thanksgiving. Yeah. People are hungry.
They
365
are.
Days a year.
And that hunger continues. And what are our kind of cultural celebrations, our national celebrations of hunger, of not hunger, but of abundance that we have, should obviously make us grateful, make us thankful, but we should also, it should make us not guilty, but make us responsible, that those who've been given much more is expected of them. And so to do that year in and year out, that there are folks who do not have enough to eat in this country. There are folks, there's children who are causing deficits that will haunt us forever, for their lifetimes, because they've not gotten the proper nutrition at those certain key, you know, 2 and 3 year old points in their lives. And so we should celebrate during these times. We should remember. We should donate. But we should also be invigorated and motivated to say, look, this is a scandal in a country that has more food than probably anybody.
Sure. And I think that it's also there is that responsibility that now that food in the last 10, 15 years has become something that we celebrate, like sports, as you mentioned earlier, you know, that to me, if we have the ability to play with our food,
exactly,
we absolutely have a responsibility to help provide for those that don't have enough to eat.
We do.
Well, thank you, Tony,
for
joining me today on Feast Your Ears. It was a real pleasure to have you.
Great to be here.
And you can find Feast Your Ears and lots of other great programs at heritageradionetwork.org and on iTunes.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.